There is a fifth dimension, beyond that which is known to man. It is a dimension as vast as space and as timeless as infinity. It is the middle ground between light and shadow, between science and superstition. It lies between the pit of man's fears and the summit of his knowledge. This is the dimension of imagination. It is an area which we call the Twilight Zone.
Good evening, everyone, and welcome to Dimensions, a Twilight Zone podcast. I'm your host, Bill Couch. On tonight's episode, we will be discussing Season 2, Episode 8, titled The Lateness of the Hour. This episode was written by Rod Serling, directed by Jack Smite, produced by Buck Houghton, music by Marius Constant and Bernard Herrmann. In the cast were Inger Stevens, John Hoyt, and Irene Tedrow. It was originally aired on December 2nd, 1960. You can watch this episode on Pluto TV, Tubi TV, Paramount Plus, or the DVDs and Blu-rays. And again, as I always do, I will stress, if you are a fan, get yourself a copy of the Blu-rays just for the crispness and clearness of the video and sound. It's well worth the money. Now, fair warning, as always, there are spoilers ahead, so if you haven't seen this episode or you haven't seen this episode in quite some time, pause it, go and watch the episode, come back, and listen to the rest of this episode of the podcast. And so without further ado, let's get to the opening narration. The residence of Dr. William Loren, which is in reality a menagerie for machines. We're about to discover that sometimes the product of man's talent and genius can walk amongst us, untouched by the normal ravages of time. These are Dr. Loren's robots, built to function as well as artistic perfection. But in a moment, Dr. William Loren, wife and daughter, will discover that perfection is relative, that even robots have to be paid for, and very shortly, we will be shown exactly what is the bill. So, this episode sees the return of Inger Stevens, and sees the introduction in the Twilight Zone, the first of a couple, to Mr. John Hoyt. And of course, for good measure, they throw in Irene Tedrow as the wife and mother. This episode was also the first of six episodes to air that was shot on videotape instead of the normal film that they use. So to say that this was a cost-cutting measure put in by the studio and the executives to, of course, save money on the per-episode production costs of each episode. Now, back in 1960, each episode of The Twilight Zone cost approximately $65,000 to produce. Now, what is that in today's money? Well, that's a good question, and thank you. I will answer that for you. In today's money, $65,000 in 1960 would be approximately $674,000 today. So, give and take, over half a million, almost $750,000 per episode to film The Twilight Zone equivalent today in 1960. So they wanted to cut costs and not diminish quality. And of course, anyone that's known any kind of business or has any sort of sense about them knows that when you cut quality, you usually have an inferior product, and business usually suffers as a result of this. So, surprise, surprise, in the Twilight Zone, it's no different. They did this to cut costs, and basically all it did was cut about $25,000 off of the production budget of each episode, so less than half, actually almost just over a third of the production cost of each episode was diminished by this cost-cutting measure. So it wasn't enough due to the quality of the product that was produced as a result of the cost-cutting to warrant keeping up with that. So only six episodes were filmed. This was the first one of the six that was aired. So throughout the rest of season two, we will have five more episodes with this format, I guess you could call it, videotape instead of film. And saving, like I said, just over a third for each episode, which isn't that much. And if you consider today, in today's day and time, a sitcom today, even a first season of a sitcom, the cost to produce usually ranges around the $1 million mark or more per episode. And that's, a season one. We're not even talking about in later seasons. If you think about Cheers or Seinfeld or The Big Bang Theory or any of these other half-hour sitcoms, basically you can figure any half-hour TV format, be it a sitcom or be it a drama, sci-fi, suspense, anthology series like The Twilight Zone. You know, the first season is considerably less money to produce than, say, season 8, 9, or 10, if you're talking about a series like Seinfeld, you know, where it ran for, what was it, 8 or 9 seasons, and Cheers, which ran for 11 seasons, and Big Bang Theory, which ran for 10 or 11 seasons, whatever it was. You've got to remember that by the end of that run, that whether it's Cheers, whether it's Seinfeld, whether it's the Big Bang Theory, you're looking at just the main characters in those TV shows are going to be making nearly $1 million, if not $1 million an episode at that last season. So automatically the production costs are tenfold what they would be, because you're looking at so much more money being spent on the talent portion and not the, you wrap it into the production cost. Obviously you have to pay the actors, but you know, season 10 of Cheers, where Ted Danson and them were getting, you know, $1 million or $850,000 an episode in 1992, 1993, you know, versus Seinfeld, you know, 6 years later when they went off the air, when all of the characters, Jerry Seinfeld, Julia Louis-Dreyfus, Michael Richards, and Jason Alexander were all making $1 million an episode at that time. So you're looking right there at $4 million without touching any of the crew members, any of the set design, set building, permits cost to do things, you know, any of that. So you're looking at, just per episode in the last couple seasons, $4 million without touching any of the actual production costs. So this cost-cutting measure, while you could, so you save a third of that. So you're basically cutting off Jason Alexander's salary plus dipping into a little of Julia Louis-Dreyfus's salary. So instead of $4 million per episode just for the cast, you're now looking at, and that's just the main cast. We're not even talking about the tertiary cast like Newman or any of the other random characters that they have on the show. you're talking just the main cast, you're still looking at least $2.5 million per episode without even touching, you know, lighting or anything else. So saving a third, while it might sound like a good idea, if the quality is not there, then it's a bad idea. And it's something that Hollywood occasionally gets right, but a lot of times they're so busy and trying to save money that they don't think about the end product. All they care about is making the money. And it's a sad state of affairs. But ultimately, it's business, and business is business. So, with that being said, let's get to the actual episode, not hear me just drone on about production costs of television shows from 64 years ago. So, this episode opens with Inger Stevens looking out a window of, you know, we get an exterior shot of the place, and the place looks like the Hearst Castle that William Randolph Hearst built. It's enormous. It looks bigger than the Hermitage from The Howling Man on the outside. But you've got Inger Stevens, who plays Jana, looking out the window, and looks like she's kind of lost in thought. Meanwhile, her mother is sitting in a chair being massaged by a woman in a maid's outfit, and her father is sitting in a chair reading a book. And you get the idea that, of course, these people, just by the size of the house and everything, and the fact that they have servants, you know, lead you to believe that these people are upper crust, which of course they are. We find out that the old man was a scientist who had retired, and his work was in, we assume, robotics, given the nature of the episode. Now, what do I mean by that? I mean, they've got six different domestic helpers, which is a nice way to put it, I guess. They have a maid, they have a handyman, gardener, they have a butler, they have a housekeeper, and they have a cook. You know, they have these different people, and they are all, to quote Rod Serling, robots. Now, this man made lifelike robots to basically do everything for him, up to and including putting on and taking off his evening slippers and packing his pipe and lighting his pipe for him. Not to disparage the man, but if you have the means, why wouldn't you? You know what I mean? So the story, of course, focuses on Inger Stevens' character of Jana, who comes to realize that she wants more from life than living in a house that is a constant 72 degrees and being waited on hand and foot by people that aren't actually people, that Dr. Lauren had created himself in his laboratory. So we see Jana basically throw a fit that her mother is being massaged by the housekeeper, and that, you know, everything is so perfect that, you know, everything is at your own, at your beck and call, and you want for nothing and except for human interaction, which, you know, she suggests, well, instead of eating here, why don't we go out to dinner? And of course her father turns her down and says, well, you know, we're going to go out in the rain, we're going to get soaking wet, we're going to eat greasy, unpalatable food served on unwashed dishes, and, you know, we'll sit and wonder whether the pneumonia or the ptomaine is going to get us. And of course Jana doesn't like this. She wants to go out, she wants to meet people. And we go through the first part of the episode of Jana wanting to break free, basically throwing an adult hissy fit, I guess is one of the better ways to put it. Rebelling against her father and her mother and their lifestyle and their ways, and storming off like a child, insulting the help, and ultimately throwing one of them down a flight of stairs, which in a very creepy scene in the Twilight Zone, the woman, actually, before she gets thrown down the stairs, the maid actually, like, sasses Jaina and, like, kind of sarcastically kind of roasts her a bit, and Jaina throws her down the stairs, and then you see the woman fall down the stairs and then get up and have this real devious and creepy sort of smile on her face. It's very well done by the actress that did it. Very well done. And it's very creepy, and I really liked it. But ultimately, Jaina rebels against her parents, rebels against the idea that they're living in this mausoleum, basically waiting around to die in the most comfortable setting that's humanly possible, next to the Wall-E chairs from Wall-E, and she wants more out of life. She wants to maybe go out and meet a man and have grandchildren, or have people over for parties and get-togethers and everything else. And of course her parents are dead set against this, especially when it comes to the grandchildren. And then we get to Jaina looking through the photo album and realizing that while there are pictures of the maid and the gardener and the butler and the cook for the last 20 to 30 years, there is no picture of Jaina from the last 20 to 30 years. About the last year or two, but that's about it. Now, the good doctor explained that he made all these people, the maid sassed Jaina, and the reason that the other help found her to be very insolent and even told her so, is that the doctor built them in the ability to have emotions and feelings, as well as to have memory tracks. So each robot was built for a specific purpose and given a backstory, so to speak, in the parlance of Hollywood. It was given a backstory. So the maid was a maid, or the maid was meant to be a maid. The butler was meant to be a butler. The cook was meant to be a cook. And they can all recount everything up to their early childhood and everything they did up until the point that they became a maid or a butler or a cook. And we finally get to, in Act 3, the realization that, or the Jaina comes to the realization that she is also a robot built by the doctor to serve as their daughter. So the butler was built as a butler, the cook was built as a cook, the maid was built as a maid, and the daughter was built as a daughter. And the doctor explained that they did this because they couldn't have children of their own, and they always wanted a daughter, so they built a daughter as best they knew how. And then we get the great scene of Inger Stevens going up the stairs and explaining that, you know, she was a daughter built as a daughter, and she has capacity for, you know, knowing where she, what she went through as a child with the memory track, but she has no capacity for love. And then she starts banging her arm on the railing and saying, "See, I feel no pain. I feel no pain. And I feel no love." And the doctor dismantles all of his other robots, and he has a chat with his wife, and his wife says, "I love her so much, I don't want you to dismantle her." And the doctor says, "No, I agree. There's too many feelings there for me to just dismantle her. I can't do it. And so the final shot of the episode is the old man sitting in a chair, reading a book, and the wife sitting in her chair, having her shoulders massaged by the maid, which is Jaina. And that is where the episode ends. So with that, let's get to the closing narration. Let this be the postscript. Should you be worn out by the rigors of competing in a very competitive world, if you're distraught from having to share your existence with the noises and neuroses of the 20th century, if you crave serenity but want it full-time and with no strings attached, get yourself a workroom in the basement and drop a note to Dr. and Mrs. William Lauren. They're a childless couple who made comfort a life's work, and maybe there are a few do-it-yourself pamphlets still available in the Twilight Zone. So thus ends the episode. A lot of people do not like the videotape episodes, but I really do, and especially one that'll be coming up called 22. It adds a creepiness factor that I think was unintentional, but albeit a very fortuitous happenstance that it did this. It adds a layer of creepiness to the episodes that was not seen before in the regular film versions. Now, of course, you lose the ability for a lot of different editing and different things, because you're basically when you shoot it on videotape, you're basically shooting it like a play. So you don't really have the ability to do a lot of different things that you would if you were shooting it on film. You're shooting it on videotape, like a 2 or 3 camera setup, very much like a sitcom is filmed today, or even, you know, from 30 years ago, like Cheers or like Seinfeld. You know, you're looking at a 2 or 3 camera setup instead of the ability to do all the different other editing and shots that can be done with different setups that you can do filming on film rather than videotape. And it's a difference that sort of comes through, because it looks almost like you're watching a play instead of a television program. So it adds a little creepiness, but it detracts a little bit of the ability to properly tell the story, I think, the way that it should have been told or could have been told had it been filmed on film and then went through the editing process and et cetera, et cetera. Now, does that mean this is a horrible episode? By no means. By no means does it. This episode always kind of... I always kind of liked. I always was very fascinated by this episode, because it was the first one I ever saw filmed on videotape instead of the normal film. So it was, like I said, it added that creepiness factor, and it always stuck with me. And of course, you've got great talent, although Inger Stevens kind of overacts a little bit, in my opinion. But you have the ever inimitable John Hoyt and the ever lovely Irene Tedrow playing the mother and the father, who do a fantabulous job of, you know, in their work. So while it's not, you know, we're not looking at a top 10 episode here, we're not looking at a top 25, top 50 maybe, it's definitely middle third of the pack for sure. It's not a masterpiece, but it's nowhere near the bottom of the barrel either. But it is a good episode, and I certainly do like it. So, with that, let's get on to the bios. Now, this episode was written by Rod Serling, of course, directed by Jack Smite, who directed actually a total of 4 different episodes of The Twilight Zone. We saw him in season 1, the episode The Lonely, with Jack Warden and as the man's imprisoned on the astronaut who gets the robot companion and has to leave her behind when he gets pardoned and taken off of the asteroid. Great episode, great acting, also involving a robot built as a person. So maybe Jack had kind of a, ability to do that. But if you want to go back and listen to his bio, listen to the episode The Lonely in season 1. Very good episode. Very good episode indeed. And you will hear more about his bio. And of course, we will see him again because he directs in this season, in season 2, 3 of the 6 episodes that are shot on videotape instead of film. So he shoots Lateness of the Hour, he shoots Night of the Meek with Art Carney, the Christmas episode, and he also shoots the ever creepy, ever frightening 22, where we get Arlene Martel's "Room for One More, Honey" line, which is awesome, in my opinion, as a Twilight Zone fanatic and a podcaster about the Twilight Zone. So we'll get to 22 before you know it. Now, let's move on to Inger Stevens. Now, if you want to know about Inger Stevens, I went into her biography at length in the season 1 episode, The Hitchhiker. Sadly, and if you go back and listen to it, great episode also, by the way. If you go back and listen to it, she sadly succumbed to suicide not very long, after this episode was filmed. And I don't mean very long as in like months. She lived for a number of years after this, but succumbed to suicide and short time, as it were, in the scheme of things. So her biography is somewhat tragic, and her life was definitely cut short, sadly. So with that, let's move on to Mr. John Hoyt. Now, Mr. John Hoyt was born in 1905 and passed away at the age of 85 in 1991. Now, he was born in New York, and he was an actor and writer known for the movies When Worlds Collide, Spartacus, and Brute Force. And he died in 1991 in Santa Cruz, California. Now, what do we know John Hoyt from? Well, I'll tell you what we know John Hoyt from. We know John Hoyt from The Twilight Zone, of course. We know him from this episode, and we know him from Will the Real Martian Please Stand Up? And by goodness, we will get there when we get there. But certainly a great episode, to be sure. Now, John has 258 acting credits on his IMDb, which goes all the way back, and I mean all the way back, to the 1946 movie OSS, and starring in several other movies throughout the 40s, like The Bribe, The Decision of Christopher Blake, The Lady Gambles, The Great Dan Patch, etc., etc. You know, he keeps going through the 50s, early 50s, playing parts in movies until, of course, the advent of television becomes a household thing. And then he starts appearing in episodes of things like Lights Out, The Racket Squad, Dangerous Assignment, the Philco Television Playhouse, Fireside Theater, the Chevron Theater, the Danny Thomas Show, the Loretta Young Show, Mr. and Mrs. North, the Pepsi Cola Playhouse. You know, stop me if you've heard some of these. The Adventures of Rin Tin Tin, the Mickey Rooney Show, all while still doing some movies as well, such as playing Mr. Warnke in Blackboard Jungle in 1955. But television seemed to be his, what kind of kept him going in between the movies, playing in things like Lone Wolf, Crossroads, the Ford Television Theater, Schlitz Playhouse, the George Burns and Gracie Allen Show, Lux Video Theater, Studio 57, General Electric Theater, stop me if you've heard any of these, The Californians, Jane Wyman Presents the Fireside Theater, Studio One, Mike Hammer, you name it, he's been in it. Now, with that being said, after his two-episode run in The Twilight Zone in Season 2, he went on to be in westerns like Bonanza and Rawhide, then, of course, in Perry Mason, Destry and Dr. Kildare and Wagon Train and all these other things, Alfred Hitchcock Presents and Alfred Hitchcock Hour. Basically, the man just worked pretty steady throughout the 50s, 60s, and 70s. Also appearing in the 70s TV version of the movie Planet of the Apes. Going into the 80s, he basically just appeared in a number of movies like Desperately Seeking Susan with Madonna, Alvin Goes Back to School in 1986, and his last on-screen appearance was in 82 episodes of the television show Gimme a Break, starring Nell Carter as Grandpa Stanley Kaniski. So he played in 82 episodes of Gimme a Break with Nell Carter as his last on-screen appearance. He was a great character actor, and we will definitely see him again later this season in one of my favorite episodes of all time, Will the Real Martian Please Stand Up? So let's move on to from the lateness of the hour to the elderly woman of the hour, Miss Irene Tedrow. Now, Irene Tedrow was born in 1907 and passed away at the age of 87 in 1995. So she and John Hoyt were basically the same age as each other, basically lived as long of a life as each other. Irene Tedrow does have approximately 206 credits on her IMDb, so slightly less than Mr. Hoyt, but certainly no slouch when it comes to on-screen acting appearances in movies and television shows. She's another one of those people that you look at her and you know her from somewhere, but you may not necessarily be able to tell where you know her from. And, you know, real good character actors are that. So she was very well known on TV with her characters and whatnot, being a character actor. But she was very first and foremost a lady of the stage. Of course, being born and starting acting in a time before there was television. She trained in drama at Carnegie Tech in Pittsburgh, graduating with a Bachelor of Arts degree in 1929. Her wheelhouse, so to speak, was playing puritanical meddlers and no-nonsense matrons. She seldom, if ever, found a really solid part that really could stretch her acting ability, so to speak. She was a founding member of the Old Globe Theater and was featured in such classical plays, play productions as Richard III, Hamlet, and Henry IV, Part I. She was also a player on radio during the war years, notably for the role of Miss Janet Archer in the popular serial Meet Carlos Archer, which she transferred to TV with that role for one season. She appeared in hundreds of episodic guest appearances for nearly 35 years in everything from Dragnet, The Andy Griffith Show, and The Twilight Zone, to The Facts of Life, Saint Elsewhere, and L.A. Law. So she had a long career, and let's go over a few of the things that you might know her from. But let's start at the beginning. Her first on-screen appearance was in the 1940 movie We Who Were Young, where she was an uncredited office girl. She went in to play more movies throughout the 40s, you know, making, as they did, many movies in the 40s. You could be in, you know, several movies a year. But she definitely transitioned well into television, playing on episodes of Public Defender, The George Burns and Gracie Allen Show, Dragnet, like they said, The Millionaire, The Johnny Carson Show from the early to mid-50s, if you remember that, before he was host of the Tonight Show, The Loretta Young Show, General Electric Theater, Red Skelton Hour, Climax, stop me if you've heard all these. She was in the movie The Ten Commandments with, of course, The Ten Commandments, the 1956 epic starring, of course, Mr. Charlton Heston and Yul Brynner. The Schlitz Playhouse, Lux Video Theater, Playhouse 90, of course, The Twilight Zone, where she was actually in two episodes. One was in Walking Distance, where she played Gig Young's mother when he travels back to the past. And then, of course, this episode. She was also in Sea Hunt with Lloyd Bridges. And she was in Alfred Hitchcock Presents and Alfred Hitchcock Hour, which usually you have a lot of crossover with that, from The Twilight Zone to Alfred Hitchcock Presents and Alfred Hitchcock Hour, especially with a lot of the secondary characters. She was also in an episode of Branded, which some listeners might be shocked to learn that, Arthur Digby Sellers did not write the bulk of the series. She also appeared in one episode of The Farmer's Daughter, which starred Inger Stevens, which was shortly before her death. She played Miss Foster in a season 5 episode of The Andy Griffith Show titled Opie's Newspaper, and went on to be a character in several episodes of several different TV shows throughout the 60s, 70s, and 80s. Her last two on-screen appearances were in an episode of L.A. Law in 1988 and in the movie A Deadly Silence in 1989, passing away only a few years after that movie was filmed. And what a lot of people may not know about her is, while she was acting in all these different television shows and parts and movies, she never left the stage and appeared well into her elderly years on stage in plays. So, and then she passed away in 1995. So that will do it for our bios. So let's go to trivia. Not much trivia in this episode, save for the fact that this is one first of six episodes to air that was filmed on videotape instead of film, which we already talked about at length earlier. And Rod Serling does not appear for his opening monologue on screen till almost 7 minutes into the episode, which is a rarity for it to be that long before he pops out and does his thing. But I will say that his appearing on screen in this episode is one of my favorite entrances of his in the series. And I always love it when he pops out from actually being in the scenery to be, you know, basically in that world and then give us the opening monologue, or opening narration, I should say, of the show. So with that, let's move on to the goofs of the episode. So after Jaina finishes banging her fist on the staircase handrail, a shadow moves behind her. As it moves, it appears to be an arm shadow, but not from Jaina. As Jaina and her father are arguing in the study, the camera cuts to a shot of Mrs. Lauren sitting in an overstuffed chair watching them. At that moment, a shadow passes across her body. It's either a crew member or a piece of camera equipment. Since there are only two other characters in the scene and neither one of them are nearby Mrs. Lauren. And then lastly, but not leastly, it seems unlikely that Jaina, who likes looking through picture albums, apparently never before wondered why she could never find a childhood picture of herself. Which is true, I suppose, but we don't really know how long she was really alive, other than save maybe a year. We're not really sure on that, so you can't really, I mean, it is a goof, I suppose, or a slight a plot hole in the episode. Is it really anything to get in a tizzy about? No. So with that, let's move on to the likes and dislikes. I like this episode. I like the direction. I like the camera work, with as limited as it can be in the early days of like a three camera setup, you know, shot on videotape anthology series. But I think Jack Smite did a great job. I think, as always, John Hoyt and Irene Tedrow did a great job. Inger Stevens, normally very good. I think she hammed it up a little bit too much in this episode. Very good in The Hitchhiker. Definitely the better performance of the two that she was in. I thought she was a little too over the top in this episode. And it's, again, just my opinion. If your opinion differs, write me an email at DimensionsTZPodcast@gmail.com, and I would love to hear your thoughts on it about previous episodes, future episodes, or this episode. Drop me a line. Let me know. Let me know what you think. And I like that, but I disliked her acting was a little over the top for me. But I like the videotape. I like the creepiness factor that it added. I think the supporting characters playing the maid and the butler and the handyman and all of them did a fair job of acting like somewhat sentient robots. And I think it was fairly well done. Like I said, is it top tier for me? No, but it's definitely not bottom tier. It's somewhere in the middle, I believe. But if you think differently, drop me a line. Let me know. DimensionsTZPodcast@gmail.com. Let me know. I'd love to hear from you. Now, let's move on to casting. So if Hollywood were to call me and say, Bill, we're going to make this episode again, we're going to cast it with contemporary actors of the day, who would you want to play Mr. and Mrs. Lauren and their daughter, Jaina? And I thought about this, which I always do. But I think it would be really cool to see Ted Danson and Mary Steenburgen, who are actually married in real life and have been for 100 years. Both very competent and very good actors and actor and actress. I would love to see them play Dr. and Mrs. Lauren. And for their daughter, I would like to see Aubrey Plaza do it. Because that girl can actually act more than just being a sarcastic, bratty woman. And she can definitely, you know, if you've seen any of her stuff in, like, lower budget movies that may not be mainstream, anything that isn't Parks and Rec, I mean, you'll know that she actually has a bit of range on her. And she can actually do more than just be the, you know, sort of goth, sort of mean girl, I guess you could say. And the ages are fine, because Aubrey Plaza is right at 40, and Ted Danson and his wife are in their early 70s. So it works perfectly. And that would be a great cast, in my mind, all the way around. Of course, if you differ, if you have any other suggestions, give me an email. DimensionsTZPodcast@gmail.com. I'd love to hear from you. So with that being said, let's move on to the moral or philosophy of the episode. Now, with this being said, I think this episode, sometimes you come across something that translates better into today than maybe it even did back then, and I certainly think this episode is one of them, because you get the sense that while this is basically an episode about a robot becoming sentient and, you know, wanting to break free from being a robot, as Mr. Serling would say, to me it's more than that. To me it's a, you got to remember the time you're looking at. This was 1960. This was post-war, when Madison Avenue was riding high and automation was becoming king. You know, this was the time, and during this time in the larger cities like Chicago and New York and Los Angeles, you had the automats, where businessmen and businesswomen and secretaries and people on lunch could walk into one of these places, and you put, you know, 50 cents or a quarter into a machine, and kind of like a vending machine, and you could pull out a sandwich and like a piece of pie, or a sandwich and some fruit or something like that, and have a lunch for a small cost. And all the lunches, all the plates were packed by people working behind the big wall of slots for the food, and they were making the food and refilling the slots as the slots got emptied by the businessmen and women that would go there to eat a inexpensive and quick lunch during their lunch hour. And, you know, if you watch any video, you can go on YouTube and find hundreds of them, of, you know, the kitchen of the future and the modern kitchen of today and the house of tomorrow and that sort of stuff. Little, you know, infomercial, or not even necessarily infomercial, but videos that are showing people like what your kitchen could look like, you know, with the modern washer and dryer and the modern, you know, range and the modern dishwasher and these sort of things that were all very new and very exciting and somewhat expensive for people in the 50s and the 60s. And, you know, 2 years later, after this episode is filmed, is we get the Jetsons, where they have Rosie the Robot and, you know, everything is automated and everything is at the touch of your fingers. And this was the quote-unquote world of the future they were wanting to look at. So you get that, but I think you can dig even deeper and look at it even today with the advent of things like Alexa and AI and all these different robotics and different automation that's coming out, that's increasing and rapidly being improved upon daily, weekly, and yearly in this day and age. You know, we went from, you know, the height of luxury was having a car phone in the 80s or even late 70s, to now having the entire internet on something that's 6 inches long and 3 inches wide that fits in your pocket. So, you know, go figure. But I think what you could look at is that you can't let the technology overtake us. And run our lives, you know, because it's a short walk from being Dr. and Mrs. Lauren having six people at their beck and or six robots at their beck and call to do anything they please for them to the WALL-E chairs from WALL-E. It's a short walk. So, and I know we're talking about science fiction from 1960. No one's built lifelike robots today. We have robots today, and we have other things, but none of them are lifelike, and none of them are at the level of sentience that they were in this episode. Not saying that that couldn't happen in another 5 years, 10 years. Who knows? But we're not there yet. But like I said, it's a short walk. So I think maybe the idea of this episode is to not become too dependent on modern things, because it'll be the ruination of us. And with that, I think we can safely bring this episode in for a landing. Stay tuned for next week's episode, where we see a man travel back in time to a place he isn't welcome. So stay tuned for next week's episode, The Trouble with Templeton. And I just wanted to say to all the, 15 or 16 people now that listen to me, I appreciate you all very much. Thank you for listening. And I hope you have a good week. Take care, everybody.